Strap yourself in,
because we're set up, switched on, and ready to go.
Episode of our podcast. Today we are going to interview some of the greatest and most influential minds in our field. By sharing our collective expertise, we will show you how to harness, control, and use your own skill set to achieve ultimate success and live the life you want. And now, please welcome your host.
Welcome to this week's Smallcast podcast. This podcast is designed for small government contractors, service providers, and manufacturers as part of the government contractor ecosystem, connecting people, organizations, and resources. I'm your host, Just Nate, and this week we have remote with us. We have Mr. Shane McCall from Coprince McCall and Potroff LLC. He's an equity partner there. Welcome, Shane.
Welcome. Thank you, and I'm glad to be here today. It's great to be on the podcast and talking to small businesses and other contractors out there.
Yes, it's definitely unique. I think you aren't our first and law firm that we've had on, but I guess you're probably our first larger law firm. How big is your guys' firm?
Well, it's actually, it's not too big. In the law world, they call it a boutique firm, which is just fancy for kind of focusing on one issue, which kind of means small. But we have about five attorneys is kind of what we keep around, and we found that's a good size so that we're not getting too large, so that we still have that kind of small office, small team feel. But we can kind of ramp up if things in our business, things kind of go in and out, they cycle, get busy, kind of with the seasons of federal contracting, and
sure,
that's enough attorneys that we can kind of meet those needs, but not be too big. Okay. So we can kind of maintain that small feel. So
nice.
And we have a few support staff as well to kind of keep everything moving, and yeah, they're great.
you get to the point where you're too small to take on anything massive, and unless you try to do a quick surge. But then after that massive project's done, you don't want to have to get rid of people. So it's that balancing act. I know Dennis and I here in the smalls, even as a nonprofit, we're playing that balancing act right now. We're right on that precipice of going big. We now have, we started this whole smalls thing back in 2017 with two people, and now we have over 700 members, and it's still those two people that are running everything. So
wow.
it's a lot. It's gotten big just in the very, very short time. The podcast now that you guys are on right now, we've started this 2 years ago every single week for a little over 2 years now. And we've grown it to our listenership just on Spotify alone, for example, is heard in 47 different states, 19 different countries.
Wow.
I've had the Pentagon reach out to us. They want to get on the podcast. So it's getting out there.
Oh, cool.
It's kind of funny. We just started this thing just for a fun thing to do. And apparently we hit upon something that people at least tune in every week and listen to us rant and whatever stupid stuff that we say, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, that's awesome that you're kind of giving out information, but you're also kind of bringing people in too from government and the contractor side too. That's really cool.
So Shane, tell me where are you currently located?
We are located in Lawrence, Kansas, which is right outside of Kansas City. So we're kind of, we're in the Midwest. We're not, one day drive more or less from Colorado where you are if you drive kind of a long day. A lot of the, a lot of the firms in this field and in the federal contracting space are near DC in the DC area, although there's some around different parts of the country. But we kind of have that a little bit of Midwest sensibility, but we are always sort of have our eye towards DC. So we can stay up to speed on what's going on out there, but we kind of have a little different, we have a little different sensibility, a little different slower pace of life out here. So it's a nice place to be. It's a college town. You know, University of Kansas is here.
Okay.
So we just had the Jayhawks win the college basketball championship. So that's a big thing in our town.
There you go. I get it where you're coming from. I grew up in a town of 500 people in North Dakota. So my entire family's still back in North Dakota. So I fully understand how you grew up. And I personally don't think there's anything better than, you know, the Midwest. Of course, no place like home, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we talked when we, you know, meet with our clients and talk to our clients, it's all pretty much done virtually. Most of our, it's actually kind of rare that we have somebody that's nearby. And so people are, and almost everyone nowadays is fine with that because there's so many, you know, virtual meeting, technologies and, you know, we can work remotely. So it seems to work well for our clients. Maybe get the occasional one that's local and we can meet in person, but that's kind of the,
I was actually curious. Have you seen a move back to it now, back to people asking for more in-person stuff?
Not really. Although when I'm, you know, I do speaking events and things like that. So like when I was in DC, last fall, I did meet with a few clients just to kind of say hi and just connect with them in person, but there hasn't been really a request for that too often. Okay. Most people, I mean, you know, we have a lot of clients that are in the IT space and a lot of them say, hey, we've been remote for years, so we don't know any other way. So when, you know, during the pandemic, they didn't have to change much at all because they have an office, but yeah, no one's really in there and it's all just done remotely for those firms.
It's one of those fine lines though. I noticed, you know, once the world came to a near end with COVID, everybody moved to the remote thing. I was doing remote 18 months prior to it, before it even hit. I absolutely hated it. I am not a full remote person. I love talking with people in person. There's something that you miss when you're not in person. And I see it in my own children. I've got three young children, age 8 to 15. And they're, even now, my 15-year-old daughter, she has a tough time talking to people in person, right? I mean, like literally, she'd be like, I can't wait. I can't believe my friend hasn't texted me back yet. I'm like, well, did you call them? Well, why would I call them? I can't talk to them. I'll just text them or I'll Snapchat them or I'll, I'm like, we've lost that capability, I think. And my fear is we're going to lose more and more of that if we don't start doing some stuff back in person again.
Yeah. So. Well, I will say for our office, you know, people that work in our office, most of us are working in person, although it kind of goes in and out when somebody, you know, has a sick kid or something, they'll work remotely. But then I have some of our attorneys that kind of have come from a different, you know, their last place they worked was remote and they want to get back in the office. And I sort of feel the same way. I have been back in the office for quite a while and it is nice to connect with people and have those conversations in person back and forth. But then we want the flexibility so that people can work from home if there's weather or they're sick, all those things. But
I think that's really what COVID has done for us, the benefit of it. Everybody says, well, the benefit is that I can work full-time remote. For me, it's more of, I think it's forced companies and customers into the aspect of, well, we can, if somebody is sick, if you have a sick kid, you don't have to take time off of that. Just say, I'm working remote today. That's fine, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, lots of, or if you're having to travel, right? I'm getting ready to travel for my daughter's softball games. Well, when I'm not on the ball field, I can be working. It's not a big deal. As long as I have internet connection, I can work from anywhere.
Yeah. And it did make sure everyone's kind of ready. Okay. What can I do? How can I set things up at home if I do want to work from home? And then you're not kind of caught in the lurch if you do need to do it.
Yeah.
I was having an issue when my kids who are now first and fourth grade, but you know, my daughter was in kindergarten and son's third grade and they're both working, or they're working, I should say, doing schoolwork remotely. And then I was also remote. And then it gets a little hectic when you have, you know, three people doing kind of like basically like virtual meetings all day at the same time. And you're like, That's a lot of bandwidth. It's also kind of loud.
Yeah, exactly.
When the kids are supposed to interact in a kindergarten. That was the tough one. You're like, how can you do kindergarten remotely? Did it. But yeah, my daughter really, the kids were, it tires them out, but they were very excited to go back in person. Yes.
I think you miss out on a lot. That social skill.
Yeah.
But so Shane, tell me about the firm. What do you guys specialize in?
I'd say we specialize in working with small business federal contractors on any issues where they are basically facing kind of face to face with the government, the federal government, as a prime contractor. And then to some extent, we also have a lot of our practices in some transactional documents and advice on partnering with other businesses. So, you know, like a joint venture, you know, maybe a typical client for us is either a small business and they want to kind of expand their footprint, go into a mentor-protege program, mentor-protege agreement with a large business, and maybe they're a service-disabled veteran-owned small business company or an 8A company, and they want to make sure, you know, what are the rules, what's the opportunities, how can we maximize our business development within the confines and the structures and procedures that are out there, and then also make sure you're kind of looking over their shoulder if they're getting input from a larger, more experienced mentor, and they want some feedback on that. They kind of want to say, okay, which things should we go along with them on? Which things maybe should we negotiate a little harder on when they're drafting like a joint venture agreement? So that may be our kind of typical client. Okay. And then we also sort of help people within the different rounds of the procurement process. And by that, I mean, you know, the transactional stuff and some of those partnership type agreements are, hey, we're preparing to bid. How can we have a teaming agreement? Or how can we have a joint venture to go after these proposals? And we also help people with, like, you know, solicitation interpretation questions. And then as part of the solicitation kind of review or as part of the evaluation process, we may help them with thinking about and even in some cases filing bid protests as part of that process. And sometimes, you know, I always say our goal isn't to talk you into a protest, because sometimes we're talking people out of a protest and they just want to get an honest assessment of it. What are their, you know, what are the chances? And so I'm never going to go in there thinking I'm going to try and talk someone in protest. In fact, we're always telling people, well, there's some issues there. And then the final, maybe the other side of that is a lot of small business administration compliance and issues with size and socioeconomic status. And then the final piece that we work on quite a bit is the contract. I call it contract administration. Say you're faced with a cure notice or inquiry from a contracting officer. And a lot of times our role is we're advising them advising a company on its rights or helping them write a response or something like that. And kind of trying to smooth the issue over if possible. Of course, that's always the goal. And then occasionally working on the back end, if there's like a, you know, claim process or something like that. That's, you know, obviously the last resort for most companies. They don't want to get to that point. So we always try to avoid it if possible, but sometimes we end up helping people with that process as well.
Okay. So you guys, that's really good. I didn't realize you guys were kind of focused on just that small business acquisition side of work. You don't see a lot of law firms doing that right now. I know a handful out here, but I mean, the majority is not. Take it back real quick. Wonder if you can explain to the listeners out there what a MP and JV are. You know, I think a lot of people know, but at the same time, Miles, we live in this world of acronym soup. And let's just take it back real quick and kind of, if you can explain to the audience what the difference is between those two, what they are, and then how they could be beneficial and limitations.
Oh, sure. I mean, yeah, and that's something we do in our practice a lot. We work with companies on those fronts, and then we also do kind of educational things. We're doing webinars for different organizations where we go through all those things in detail. So, but I'll try to keep it short, of course, on this podcast. We won't get into all the wrinkles.
Yeah. There's
so mentor protege, you know, your most common way people are going to approach that is the Small Business Administration has a set of rules and a program to allow two companies, a more experienced company, to provide all different types of assistance, mainly business development assistance, to a small business. And if it's kind of within the framework that the SBA has set out, then you get these special exceptions, or you kind of get an insulation against risk or a reduction of the potential concerns that could occur if a large business is working incredibly closely with a small business. And you hear about things like a large business maybe taking advantage of a small business and their socioeconomic status. What the mentor protege program says is we want to encourage that sort of cooperation, and we set out a framework for how to do it the right way that's approved by the Small Business Administration. And it takes away some of that worry that maybe a large business would have of, you know, if you're working too closely with a small business, there's this risk of affiliation, which is SBA's rules for saying, hey, if you're affiliated, you might no longer be a small business and lose your small business status. So if you're in a mentor protege program, you basically don't have to worry about that as much. That is assuming you kind of follow all the steps, jump through the hoops, and get your mentor protege agreement approved. And I look at the list of the SBA publishes a list. It's a Excel spreadsheet that they put on their website of all the approved mentor protege agreements. You check it every once in a while, and there's about, I think there's close to 1,500 of them that have been approved. Wow. So we're not talking about some kind of hidden program out there. It's very much encouraged by the Small Business Administration.
And I want to ask the question, is there limitations? Like you can only do three contracts or proposals together? Is that part of that, or is that JV?
That's more on the joint venture side. There are some limitations on the mentor protege side in terms of, the main ones are, well, the total time for one mentor protege relationship is 6 years. So you kind of get 6 years to do as much as you can within that 6 year period.
Okay.
The other main limitation is that a protege or the small business can only have two approved mentor relationships throughout the lifetime of its business. Okay. So there is a little, you know, you want to get them right, because a lot of companies, you know, find it to be pretty advantageous, and they do end up doing two mentor protege agreements. If you kind of, unfortunately, if you have a bad relationship on the first one and you don't really get much out of it, it still counts against you.
Yeah.
SBA tried to soften that a little bit, basically giving an 18-month window. If it doesn't work out, you can kind of take that one off the list, take that one off the books, which is, you know, they made it a little more flexible, but those are kind of the main limitations on and that.
The benefit to both really is you can share your capes and your quals, right? Qualifications, where the big can use your qualifications as maybe a socioeconomic status, right? Or, and then you can use as a small, if you want to try to prime something, you can then use the big's quals behind you as well, right?
Right, exactly. You can, well, yeah, so the mentor, yeah, kind of gains access to those set-aside procurements, because they can sort of, you know, join forces with the protege. If the protege is an 8A, then you can form a joint venture with them through the mentor protege agreement and then go after an 8A set-aside, for instance. Okay. So that's the difference between the mentor protege program and the joint venture agreement is the mentor protege program is sort of just like the framework, kind of like the setup to do a bunch of different types of business development assistance. One of the most common one that people want to go after is to form a joint venture. if the mentor is a large business for the particular procurement, the only way that the two companies can do a joint venture is if they already have an approved mentor-protege agreement.
Okay.
That's why it's a little bit more attractive to larger businesses. If you're a small business, you can do a joint venture with another small business. You don't need the mentor-protege agreement in order to do that.
Okay. And
so that's one difference.
That's where you really want to choose correctly, though, right? On the JV, to make sure you choose something that's a complement to something that you don't have a core competency in, that can help you win a program together, right?
Exactly. Because if you can already do all of those, you already have those capabilities, you have those key personnel or past performance examples, then you don't really need the mentor as much in those areas. You want it to really help you expand into a new market, maybe with a different set of agencies or under different NAICS codes or different industries, so that you can kind of expand where you already are. Or you may just be, some proteges do it, they only have a little bit of experience, or it's more on the commercial side, and they can really expand into the federal marketplace using the mentor's past performance. One thing to keep in mind, this is a big thing that we write about a lot on our blog, which is SmallGovCon, which is a big, kind of a nice tool for people out there that are just, we update that, keep the news flowing on there, so people are aware, oh, there's a new small business regulation. Okay, now I know what that is. But
I should read that.
We do. It's a good, and we do a little email newsletter that a lot of people sign up for. I think there's over 5,000 on there now. So it's it's built up some pretty good numbers over the years, and we keep it going.
People sign up for that thing? While you're talking about it, how do you sign up for the newsletter?
Go to smallgovcon.com, or we have a link on coprints.com. That's the law firm website, or there's a separate website for the blog, and there's a little sign up button on there.
Okay.
Then you get kind of a monthly digest of, hey, here's the top stories from this month. We put stuff on social media as well, like LinkedIn. It's probably the most, where we put out the most information. If there's just a little update, on the blog, we're writing up our actual, summary of all the things and the key points, and it's kind of a little bit in depth, but still easy to follow. Okay. And then on LinkedIn, we'll just kind of put out, hey, there's an interesting thing. We're not gonna write a whole article on it, but here's something to keep in mind.
Yeah.
And so one of the things we come back to, because it is a little bit of a confusing thing, is if you're in a joint venture, an agent, a federal agency has to consider the capabilities, past performance, and other attributes of the mentor and the protege. If you just do it as a prime sub and you have the small business as the prime, it's optional, or it's discretionary on the part of the agency if they have to consider the past performance and other capability factors of the subcontractor.
That is true. I've seen a lot of that lately, where they say we'll only take past performance from prime.
Right. Yeah. So, but if you go in as a joint venture, the agency has to put in their solicitation, we'll consider the past performance of both parties. So that's why a lot of large businesses are like, well, let's just be safe. Let's just do it as a joint venture. And then we can make sure our past performance is evaluated, instead of just having it be solicitation by solicitation. We need to check, is the agency going to look at the past performance as a sub? Are they going to value it less than if you're a joint venture? That's a big incentive for people to form these joint ventures. And in order to get a joint venture with a large business, you have to have the mentor-protege agreement first.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the main kind of way that the people kind of use both.
Okay.
One's a vehicle to go out and get a contract. One's the framework to allow you to form the joint venture. So go to the mentor-protege agreement first.
Excellent. Well, Shane, we're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, I've got some more exciting questions for you.
All right.
Business owners, looking for out-of-the-box solutions? Five Star Bank's Business Solutions Group is here to help you with all your financing needs. When you need a creative, innovative approach that goes beyond traditional solutions, think of Five Star Bank. We care about the growth of our local business community. With offices in Colorado Springs, Denver, and Trinidad, Five Star Bank is easy to find. Visit fivestar.bank to connect with us today. That's the number 5, STAR.bank. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Now back to the show.
Sorry, I had to use that one. That's my youngest. That's my 8-year-old. When I was working out of the house and they were at home, like you said, they'd want to take a break and they'd be like, "Hey, Dad's recording a podcast. I see he's got his recording sign up on the door or something like that." And he's like, "Dad, I want to be on the show too." So I was like, we can enact that. And I've got two of my 3 kids that have sound bits that we use. It's not child labor, just so you guys know, right? I pay them with Starbucks or whatever else that they need that day.
I have to ask, did you let them draw a little sign that says recording in progress and tape it up there?
They did. It is taped up there. I should put that out for people to see what it looks like. I can't say that I've never lost my mind when I'm in the middle of trying to record something and dad, so-and-so hit me. So-and-so said this about me. I'm like, oh.
Yeah. I tried to do a little drawing of a phone on a post-it note, and use that to put on the door when I was on a phone call. It's like, somehow I think, if it's a picture rather than the words phone call or something, then they'll recognize it right away and the kids will be quiet.
They'll probably come in, "Dad, what's this supposed to be? What is this?"
Yeah. Ooh, you're on a phone call. Ooh, what's that? What's that phone thing? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so Shane, before the break, we talked a lot about the different types of contract vehicles that you guys help out with. That includes mentor protege, joint venture, JVs. Do you have any, over the years, have you guys been doing this now? How many years has that been? Have you guys been working in the small business arena?
I've been doing it for 5 years and the firm for another couple of years before then. So maybe 7-8 years total.
Okay. Have you always been an attorney or is this like a second career for you or?
I did some other stuff. I was thinking about other options, but yeah, this has been my main career since 2010. I actually did bankruptcy law for a few years, and then transitioned into this government contracting world when there was a job opening nearby. So now it's I can tell you that the federal contracting is less stressful than bankruptcy.
Really?
So I'm glad I made that change.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Have you ever had to do any of the, contractor to contractor lawsuits or anything like that when they're teamed together and then it falls up horribly apart or?
Well, maybe it's lucky that we set it up. We don't handle those prime sub contractor lawsuits. We will do some of the drafting of like a teaming agreement. Okay. But yeah, if it comes to more of a arbitration or litigation between the prime and sub, we sometimes, we'll work with another attorney, but they'll kind of take the lead, like a litigation firm or more of a trial attorneys would take the lead on that. So now, maybe, that might make it easier for us.
Now you did mention though, something in there that you just mentioned that I want to come back to is, teaming arrangement or teaming agreement, whatever you want to call it, a TA. So typically a company's, for those of you guys out there that don't know what that is, typically how you're going to start a prime sub relationship is you're going to start with an NDA first, right? Non-disclosure agreement between both parties that really just kind of protects, your IP, for whatever conversations you're going to have. So if I tell them that my salary is $100 an hour, they're not allowed to go tell somebody else, another competitor, that's what I'm charging, right? So kind of that, and, or in the technical realm, if you end up getting into something that, might be IP related, then hopefully that would help protect a little bit. But then the TA, is that really the first place where, how legal binding is a TA, a teaming arrangement?
Well, that's actually an interesting, kind of tough question because...
spoken like a true lawyer.
I always tell people when they're going into it, it wouldn't make your first thought, "I'm going to sue if I don't get the subcontract." I mean, that's because some states it's kind of, it can be a state by state issue. Okay. There was a case out of Virginia where they said these teaming agreements, they kind of don't look like a full agreement because it just says, hey, we're going to propose together. We're going to figure out some of the details later. And so, and so it's an agreement to agree is what the judge said in that case. And an agreement to agree is not a actual agreement. It's kind of a, we're going to figure out the details later through the subcontract. So it was basically the conclusion there. It wasn't enforceable. I think in that case there was, you know, a proposed subcontractor and then the prime changed its mind and maybe went with somebody else. And then they sued on that basis. So okay. I would go into it. What we kind of tell our clients is go into it as how are you going to reach an understanding on the terms of these things? Of course you want that language in there from the subcontractor's perspective. You know, exclusivity is was one of the main things that you're going to want in there for most people. You know, we're going to prime sub on this this solicitation, this project, and you can't go then be a subcontractor to three different competitors. Most companies want that, and then you kind of want to define what's the scope of that, but it, you know, not limit you for other solicitations, maybe.
Well, from the prime, from the prime perspective, right? Not necessarily the sub's perspective.
Right.
Right.
The sub may want to have a little more flexibility, but in a lot of cases, you really, you know, you probably shouldn't be being a subcontractor on multiple proposals because, you know, you, there's some limitations on, you know, independent pricing. You have to say, well, yeah, I don't know the pricing of a of, on multiple proposals. So yeah, you may not want to do that. It depends on the solicitation, but
I guess if you consider yourself from, a vendor more than a subcon, you're more of a vendor at that point, right? Providing a product to multiple different primes of, you know, maybe the customer wants your product. They don't care who the prime is, but they really want your product. So to edge your bet, I guess, would you'd want to be on as many as possible if you're more of a vendor as a sub, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, it can get tricky. Like if it's a piece of software or something like that and you're licensing it, then yeah. Are you more of a vendor? Are you a subcontractor versus like if it's a, you know, maybe if it's a construction project or something, I guess well, you could have vendors in that situation too, but yeah, it does depend.
I've been in situations like that before where we actually had to then segregate off within the company, right? To say this team here is working this proposal and they are not allowed to talk with this other team that's working a proposal that's competing against that team. I think that would help if you wall each other off too. Mm-hmm. It might help a little bit too. But yet, like you said, I think it can get very dicey. It probably depends on the state that you're in. I've been told that multiple times that the TA is not necessarily legally binding. It's really the subcontract that is.
Right.
Now,
yeah,
I can say from experience, for those people listening out there, if you were teamed with somebody, do not break the teaming arrangement before you even propose. it's not a good way to start off that relationship between prime and sub.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, so I'm definitely not encouraging people to go out and violate their teaming agreement because it may not be enforceable. But then I view it as, it's a way to come to a mutual understanding. It's also a way you're testing whether that relationship is going to be cooperative. You know, if you can't agree on the terms in the teaming agreement, I mean, that may be a red flag to that's not going to be a good relationship going forward. So it's sort of a litmus test for how it's going to work going forward. And also it does say, well, you know, just some of the basic logistics of, hey, how are we going to divide up the proposal responsibilities? If someone can't come to terms on those things and they're being, really combative on that front, then it could bode ill for the rest of the relationship. Yeah. So you want to have it in place because you want to have those that understanding. And most people are going to view it as, you know, enforceable. They're going to view it that way because it's a kind of a good faith reason. It's just if you actually went to court, you know, I don't even want to make that call, especially not on a podcast. But it'd be even harder if you're with a client.
Now, I am not an attorney. Let me make that very, very clear. I can speak from experience that that's about all I can do. on good and bad, right? I would say 90% of the time, never had issues with teaming arrangements, but I have had experiences where teaming arrangements were broke, and it leaves a very, very bad taste in the mouth because, like you said, if it's going to set a precedence for what's to come, if you guys do win the contract together, maybe that's somebody telling me someplace that I shouldn't be on that team.
Right. Or, yeah, one of the big areas where there's always the contention is how detailed you get on the scope of work, the projector, the estimated scope of work for the proposed subcontractor. And, you know, some people are fine with keeping it vague. Other people want some very strong specifics in there. And that can really depend on your relationship with the other party. You know, our job is sort of to help translate that into something that's kind of easily interpreted and, you know, as clear as possible within the teaming agreement. And then kind of comes back to some of that's a little bit of a business decision, and then mixed in with how do we make it clear and as strong as possible with regards to like scope of work.
And I would assume from your guys' perspective, like you just said, the more clear and precise you can be, less questions would come up later, right? And if you and I were doing something together and you said, Nate, you are to build the wheels of this bicycle, and you were going to build the frame of the bicycle, if you could literally put in a drawing or a diagram of who's doing what, more of a matrix, you know, capabilities matrix or a responsibilities matrix, if you will, that's what I would want, right? So there's always going to be those few things you got to figure out after contract award and win and all kind of stuff and logistics. But having that right up front of who's doing what, it's really helpful.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. Although, you know, you do see it. It's not that infrequent when people are, you know, okay with keeping it kind of vague, even though we say, you should get more specific here. But people, you know, they want that relationship to go forward, or it's an indefinite contract, and so you can't get too specific, but you want to have something in there, just so there's some sort of understanding, even if it's at kind of a general level.
What about
I'm gonna have these categories.
FTEs, would you say get specific on how many people you're going to provide, if it's a butts and seats type contract or ANAS, and you know the contract is 500 people, and let's say we were going to split it, you know, 51-49%, would you put that in a TA to say, you guys will get 298 people? Or
I think from the subcontractor perspective, yes, you want those specifics in there. These labor categories, these positions, and maybe how many FTE. Sometimes people do like a percentage thing. And then that seems like from the prime's perspective, they always want to keep it a little bit more vague, especially if there's it's usually when there's multiple subcontractors when it gets harder, because then you say, well, you know, I've seen some definite primes where they say it's just we're going to take the best people depending on the task order, and they keep it very vague. And that's what the prime usually wants, because they don't want to be
locked down.
They want to be able to mix it.
Yeah.
Depending on what either the task order or even just to keep it flexible, because things can change.
But I like how you kind of started this conversation, as you had mentioned that when this happens a lot, you were saying something about, your guys' job is to help that small business and protect themselves, because sometimes some of the very big businesses will, I don't want to say, for lack of better terminology, I would say, so they don't take advantage of the small business, right? You want that as a small business, you want to grow, right? You want to learn, and you might not know all the legalese behind all of this. So I think that's very, very admirable of you guys helping the guys, the smalls out, to try to make sure that they're not going to be taken advantage of.
Yeah, and we've seen it, you know, time and time again. There's the occasional outlier, but we've done some teaming agreements or subcontracts with some pretty large businesses, and we're representing a small company, and most of them will listen to those comments and revisions and all that, you know, so it doesn't hurt to put them out there. They're not just going to say, we won't even review anything you send us. They'll listen to it though. And you do have to pick your battles though. If you put, if you try to revise it, you know, if a large prime sends over a team agreement, you try to revise every third paragraph, you know, they may reject that. But if you really kind of have pick your battles and pick the few key ones that are most important and have a reason for it and justify it, then they'll usually listen to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Shane, what else have you guys been working on? I mean, you said you guys five people, I mean, are five attorneys. I mean, that's, yeah, I'm mm-hmm. guessing you guys can take on quite a bit of work with five attorneys.
Yeah, we work with like companies that are just starting out. And so maybe we're working on a joint venture for them. Or one of the areas I really like is the kind of the size, world, for lack of a better term. You know, SBA rules about size and affiliation can get pretty complicated. And so you get a company that's doing pretty well. And, you know, some of these size and affiliation rules are not, intuitive, or just, they're not well publicized really. I don't think, from the SBA's perspective, they're in the SBA's set of regulations, but you can have rules that say, like, if, you know, a company's getting, you know, fairly big, you can be found affiliated with a family member's business. And people don't always realize that. So some of our work is really going through and analyzing, affiliation concerns, to where a company is like, well, you know, I have a family member, they own a business. Is there risk there of being found affiliated? If you're found affiliated with another company, you add together the sizes of both companies, and then you inadvertently are no longer a small business. So we do some kind of very, a little bit more complicated, advising when you know, a company gets bigger, mm-hmm. or they've got investors and that sort of thing. I like those things. Sometimes that results in is just kind of advising them ahead of time. Sometimes it results in like a size protest. So we'll help defend the company. Okay. You know, somebody goes in there and says, I think there's some connections between these companies. They're not really small. They're actually part of a much larger, you know, conglomerate or something like that.
So,
and even if it doesn't seem like a great argument first, the company still has to defend it.
Lots of different things coming. That's not cut and dry either, right? Because socioeconomic status, if you're an 8A, that doesn't apply, right? If you're an 8A Alaskan owned or native owned company, I mean, that's kind of the business model of that, of even though they've got a big boy behind them that might be worth billions, every 7 years they'll spin off a new small business that can then go after those set asides for 8A's, right? And you wouldn't combine those together.
Yes, there's a specific exception for tribally owned and Alaska Native entities. Okay. That says, yeah, you can have a holding company, you can have these common management and common administrative services between them, and that's not going to cause affiliation. So yeah, it's a definite exception that's written into the rules. But for a non-entity owned 8A or an individual owned 8A, they still could have those concerns. So sometimes we get people, they come to us, hey, we realize there might be an issue here. We want to have you check, make sure there is no issue, or if there is an issue, if there's a way to address it. Other times people are like, oh, we just got a size protest, and then you have to kind of make the argument after the fact that there's not an issue here and explain that to SBA.
And,
so we
and
do
those
both
things
of those.
Change as well, right? I don't know if you guys do anything with GSA, Oasis Pools type contracting, where it used to be your size standard had to be an average over the last 3 years, and now they've made it to where you can average over 5 years. So all those types of things mm-hmm. take play in that, right? And then you can pick and choose as a company of, well, which years do I choose, or which, you know, how do I define that? That's where
right.
you guys are probably coming to help with that.
Yeah, when people have a more complicated situation, like, you know, you've got an idea queue and then you've got a task order, does your size relate back in time to the original IDQ, does it relate to the task order? I mean, usually it's, I just give, you know, spoiler, it's usually relating back to the date of the first IDIQ. And then, there, you know, there's exceptions to those rules. Or say you were just acquired by another company that's now a large business. Do you still count as small for all of your contracts going forward until you bid on something new? And people sort of want to, you know, be very – clear and precise about those timing issues.
Is there are a lot of dry? Things that don't you have to finish out your contract no matter what?
I mean, the basic rule is if you're small for your initial offer with price, then you stay small. But there's an exception to that. If the contracting officer specifically requests that you recertify as small, if they request recertification in a task order request for proposals, then you would no longer count as small. But so, I don't know why contracting officers would do that. They're not really incentive to do that, but they can.
They can.
I
guess depends on how nice you've been to them for the past 2 years of your contract, right?
And yeah, and there's some tricky ones, though. There's some solicitations we've seen where, say, you have a joint venture, and the solicitation itself says, oh, yeah, if one of your joint venture members is acquired by a large business and is no longer small, even though the general rule is you get to stay small, we put a specific rule in the solicitation that says we can off-ramp you in that situation. And then, you know, which one rules? Is it a solicitation specific requirement or is it the general rule? Sometimes there's some room for arguing with the agency or kind of trying to persuade the agency for your interpretation of it.
I wouldn't argue
with
right?
some of those tricky ones.
Have a nice long conversation with the agency to discuss the possibilities and the options. So I am seeing a theme here, or you keep saying the words, it depends. I think that's a perfect, maybe that should be your guys' slogan, right? Because I think that's the reason why small businesses need to have the idea of having an attorney on the backside, right? Because it depends. There's no such thing as anything really cut and dry that I've come across. There's always something that could pop up that you might need your guys' support on.
Yeah, there are a few. I mean, and that's when people come to us and I say, oh, that one actually we can answer. A lot of times we get people reaching out to us sometimes from PTAX or just people read our blog or just send in a question. And sometimes we have a blog post and we say, yeah, actually there is an answer on that one. Here's our blog post. And then our job as attorneys is to say, okay, this part of the question is pretty cut and dry. These parts we think we know. And then these parts there's not a lot of guidance on it. And we give you our interpretation of it. So we have to divide all those up into into different levels of certainty. And sometimes there are pretty, pretty simple ones. It's unfortunate when someone comes in after the fact and they're like, well, this is fine. Right. And then it's one of those simple ones cuts against them. That's the ones where you really only come to us a little bit earlier. This one would have been a lot simpler, but, most of them are not cut and dry, but as attorneys, you really like the it's like a breath of fresh air every once in a while. Like, okay, good. This one has a clear answer. Okay. If there was too many of those, of course, you know, you wouldn't need attorneys as much, but unfortunately, laws and English language just don't always line up.
Everything else. Yeah. Yeah. That's a new one. And then of course, when the English language starts to change, that's one that really bothers me. I'm like, how do you take a word that's been there for 1,000 years and now you're going to change the meaning of it? That's just doesn't make sense to me. Well, it's contextual, right?
I will say one thing that kind of leads off that, the way we approach it when we're maybe doing a protest or talking with an agency is we're always kind of saying, so it's less, it's kind of a little bit, it is a little bit adversarial, but we take the approach of, you know, we're trying to protect the procurement system. We're trying to, you know, uphold what the rules are.
Yep.
So then we can kind of, I think if you approach it that way, then you're not saying, hey, the government's wrong or we're wrong. We're saying, what does the system say we have to do? And our job is to uphold that. And, you know, maybe we're wrong, maybe we're right. We're going to argue it the best way we can. But the goal is, you know, keeping things fair.
Which makes sense. Because it's also going to make your job easier because you're going to have more and more customers. And if you try to make a change to those rules with the one customer, now you've really changed it for everything going forward. You set a precedence, which is probably could be good, could be bad. So, Shane, what else haven't we talked about? You'd like to tell the community?
Well, I mentioned our blog. That is one of our kind of things that we really work on. Okay. I mean, it's kind of it is a marketing tool for us, but it's also a way that we kind of educate ourselves as attorneys. And I found that it's kind of a nice way to provide a resource to contractors. And we will even get agency people, government people reaching out to us with a question on it, because some people use that as kind of their way to stay up to date on certain things. And that's kind of nice to get those. Sometimes it's like, hey, we think you're wrong on this one. But other times it's like, I had a follow-up question on that. That was a good thing you wrote about.
Nice.
So it is a nice change of pace, to mix up kind of the argumentative or persuasive writing we always have to do, or the transactional things where we're being so precise. And then the blog lets us be a little bit freer and do a different type of writing. So use a different muscle. It's kind of fun.
And the website of that is www.smallgovcon.com, correct?
Yep. Yep. Exactly.
Excellent. And is that also linked to your attorney's, your co-print site?
Yes. Okay. Yep. Yeah. There's links on there that kind of show the different types of services we do. The administrative litigation, working with the agencies, that's a big part of what we do. The bid protest world. I think we were talking about, it does go in cycles. When the government is giving out a lot of awards, there's going to be more opportunities for protests. It kind of cools off and maybe in the summer, or the holiday, we always think, oh yeah, this must, sometimes we're wrong, but yeah, it usually is kind of cyclical or goes along with the holidays. Well, so
you bring that up, and I know we're running out of time here, but I do have one quick question. One last question for you, because you brought this up on the, throwing a protest. It used to be, they used to say that, you know, why not throw a protest, right? It's cost of a stamp. That's what it used to be. Maybe you can help me out. What is the cost to put a protest out if you feel that somebody made a decision in the wrong to throw a protest? It's it now costs, is that correct? Something like $275 or?
Oh, just to file it?
Yeah, to file the protest.
Well, with GAO, yeah, it costs $350.
$350, okay.
If you just want to, even if you file it yourself, you still have to pay it. There's no exceptions or waivers or anything like that. If you're doing a size protest or a status protest, I mean, you just file that with the contracting officer, and there's no cost to that sort of thing. But bid protest, yeah,
bid protest.
They did institute that now.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Which in the contractor community, I always thought it was kind of funny. I'm like, I think they did that to deter people from putting a bid protest out. But if it's $350 and it's a $1 billion contract, I don't know a single company that's not going to come up with that $350 to put a protest in for that. I don't think it stopped a single bid protest from happening, that $350 fee.
Well, yeah, probably not. I will say, you know, we look at the little GAO puts out a bid protest report, and, you know, government accountability office is the most common place that people protest. The protests have actually gone down every year for the last 5 years.
Really?
And they're actually becoming the percentage that where the agency takes corrective action or there's a sustain is a little bit going up. Not exactly a correlation, but it seems like people are getting more discerning on their protests. Maybe they're getting more information on the debriefings. It's, you know, yeah. No one knows for sure exactly, but that could be what it is. So the protests maybe are getting a little bit better. And there's less of them.
I had the best idea. I always thought, because I got so sick and tired, like literally every proposal we did would get protested. And I just got to the point, you know what? If I was king for the day, I would make sure that if you're going to throw a protest, whoever put a protest out there, if you win, great. If you lose, you pay all attorney fees for both parties and make it hurt, make it sting a little bit. And stop people from throwing frivolous protests out there. I literally, during one of our contracts that I was going after a couple of years ago, my competitor threw a protest out after we had already won the contract, threw a protest, bid protest, saying, well, you didn't tell us that we had to prove that we had this capability. And I'm like, how did that even get to the point of where I found out about this protest, right? I mean, that's crazy. I mean, they literally said, well, the government didn't tell me I had to prove that I had this capability. They just said, you have to have that capability. And I'm like, I don't, man, come on.
Some of them are
reaching.
Yeah. Some are reaching a little bit. On the other hand, you know, there's some where you, there's a particular requirement or something that's not in line with the regulations, and you do have to protest those sorts of things just to kind of keep people on the even page. The evaluation ones can be tough, but you still see issues that and they do get sustained. So, but you know, I think people are listening. There, that was a proposal. I don't know if it was in an NDAA or something to have a losing protester pay the fees, or maybe it was in one of these. There's this panel that came out of an NDAA to make recommendations. It might have been one of their recommendations, although it never made it into law because, I mean, now there's been less protests. They're sort of maybe kind of winnowing out some of the less good protests.
Well, you can only throw
so many
protests with the same customer before they're like, yeah, we don't know if we really want this person even a bid ever again, right? Because every single time they lose, they throw a protest or.
Right.
We all know those
things. But I mean, by the same token, you see these, you know, a company, it's a very large company. They're obviously very successful and they protest quite a bit. So they're not losing. They're
well,
not like,
you know,
going back.
I guess the legalness behind it, because I've also sat on the government side on reviewing contracts and I thought it was just crazy. I'm like, what do you mean I can't take this proposal and this proposal, put them side by side and compare them? They're like, oh no, that's definitely no. You got to compare each person separately from one another against the requirements, not against one another. You're never bidding against somebody else. You're bidding against the requirements. And that was a hard lesson to learn for me to be on the government side then to say, well, wow, no wonder why this is, I mean, in the real world, right? If you're on a baseball team, you have a winner and loser and I'm comparing the two, who's better. Government, at least the customer I was working for, no, that's not it. You take the requirements and independently assess each and every proposal against those requirements, not against one another.
Yeah, and it does go back to kind of what I was saying at the beginning. I always think my job as an attorney is to advise people honestly based on the, you know, solicitation, based on the precedents. Is there a good shot here? And you give people that honest opinion and have them make that decision. That's, you know, one of the kind of nice things we do as attorneys.
Nice. Well, so. Shane, we are out of time, but I appreciate you coming on the podcast today. I want to make sure just one more time, your actual website is www.koprince.com, right?
Yep.
And then your blog, you can access it from there, or you can just go to www.smallgovcon.com.
Exactly.
And Shane, how do people, companies reach out to you guys if they want to use your services?
LinkedIn is one way. People can just call in. We've got the number on the website there, or email us. We have our kind of email address on the websites there. So either one of those works. A lot of people just have a question. They, you know, send out an email from the blog and we can, even if they don't want legal advice, we'll do our best. You know, we're not going to spend hours on it, but hey, here's a quick resource for you.
Yeah.
And it can help people on their way and we'll give them a nice answer. And sometimes they need further help and we can help them and do a call and that sort of thing. But we're happy to talk to people.
And of course, we'll have your information on our website eventually here as well to just help you guys help our community. I mean, our community is provided of the entire ecosystem of government contract work. So thank you for everything you do. I'm going to go check out your guys' blog and sign up for the weekly newsletter as well myself. Because even though I am not an attorney, it's good to at least have that knowledge and know where to go get that knowledge if you ever need it. Just to keep up on, because things are always changing as well. But appreciate you coming on, Shane. And till next week, this is Just Nate signing off.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Smalls Cast podcast. Connect with us at thesmalls.org. Don't forget to sign up to our newsletter to receive our free materials. See you at the next episode.
See you at the next episode.